Welcome to After the Buzzer, the cold, chilly version. Gordy, how's it going, man?
Outstanding, sir. And yourself?
I'm well. Gordy Jones and Mike Gross. We're going to talk about the Sixers and the NFL playoffs in a bit. But first, we go hot college hoops with a local guy who's rolling at F&M, the head basketball coach there. His club is 13-3, kind of having a breakthrough season in his fifth year. Nick Deshay, welcome to After the Buzzer, my man.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going right this year with you have an experienced team, and they really have played like an experienced team. A lot of stuff happened in the at the very beginning of your tenure that kind of made things difficult, but now are you close to having it where you want it?
Yeah, you hit on experience is a big key there, and it's something we've had to, when we got back from post-COVID, we were just hit pretty heavy because really losing 2 years worth of graduation since nobody sat out and we don't have grad school. So we were, in some ways, the bones of the program were still there in terms of what we want this program to be about, but it's with guys that really hadn't experienced much in terms of on-court experience or, a conference championship type season with so many kids have experienced here when they were younger. And so it's something that's really just been built up, and we've got some guys who are now, playing in their third year as a starter or as a main contributor. So it's a nice blend of experience, some younger talent too that's infused in the last couple of years. And it's just a team that's finally been through some things. So, those games that maybe got away from us a few years ago younger team, we know how to respond and get back to playing the way we need to and fight back. And, with experienced team usually comes better discipline, better, execution. And so we're much better defensively. We're much better taking care of the ball. We're much better on the glass.
Breakthrough win the other night against maybe not a breakthrough win, but because you've been there, you've been doing it all year. But the Swarthmore game against a team that has been Final Four level in recent years. Now they're very young. Now they're on the other side of it. They're very young right now, so maybe not as dominant. But down 16 late in the first half, and you end up winning by 17. Take us through that one a little bit, how it went and how your guys responded.
Yeah, it was nothing really too complicated. I mean, Landry's first year in the league over at Swarthmore was my first year as an assistant at F&M. So I've kind of seen the genesis of the Swarthmore program to what it is now. And so I think we're two programs that are very familiar with how we like to play. I feel good about the game plan. We've got a team now that I think can do what's necessary to be a good team like Swarthmore. And, they battled some injuries and stuff this year, but I mean, they were, they had Vinny D'Angelo, and Michael Caprice, two really good players that, took a lot of effort for us, I think, to defend there. But, really what happened was we got off to a bad start, in terms of, I think, just some of the things we talked about, and it's simple stuff. It's toughness. It's making sure we rebound the ball. It's taking care of it on the offensive end and getting what we like to just say is our shots. And second half, I was able to kind of get on them a little bit at halftime, but it was really more of a readjustment than adjustment into just what was the game plan we talked about. And I have full confidence in our guys, and to their credit, they're a really resilient group. They do respond well to being challenged. They've responded well all year to fighting back and playing in close games. And so we were able to kind of dig in and chip away at the lead maybe a little more quickly than I anticipated in the second half.
Oh, okay.
And got rolling a little bit there, and really it was our defense that carried the way with that second half.
I just thought of this. You took them to overtime last year, right?
Yeah, we did. Last year at our place, it was double overtime game, kind of a tough one. That was at a point of the season where we were playing probably at our best last year before some injuries hit us. And that, maybe we just didn't handle, coming out of that loss as well, too, a combination of things. And very similar type scenario, actually, where last year I think we had an 8-point lead with 5 or 6 minutes left. Very similar type situation. And last year we allowed them to kind of claw their way back in, and this year we were able to continue to get stops and finish the job.
It was kind of amazing. You don't expect a 50-point half. You outscored them 50-23 in the second half. You held them to 28% from the field, 1-for-11 from three. And meanwhile, 25-for-33 from the foul line in the second half. That's crazy. I mean,
yeah. We'll take it. I mean, every time we play Swarthmore, it's a really kind of physical game, and I think the whistle was I think they called a good game. I mean, it was a tighter whistle, and then, you know, also at the end they started fouling us with about, you know, towards the end that maybe added to that a little. But we really, I tell our guys all the time, if you're the aggressor, you're going to get the benefit of the doubt in terms of getting the calls. And I think, you know, we were able to do that. And we got the ball into the paint. We were really good getting into offensive actions more quickly, which made it harder to guard, which puts them out of position. And we're a team that usually, even when we hadn't been as good, and I know it'd be nice if we shot like that from the free throw line every game. That's been one of our strengths.
Yeah, but, right.
We've always been a team that gets the free throw line, even when we weren't playing as well the past couple of years. We always put pressure in the paint and try to get to the free throw line. We've got guys that are good at drawing fouls. We throw the ball inside. We attack the rim. And so, you know, I think right now we're number one in our conference in free throws attempted. I think we're second in mix. If we shot a little better percentage, we'd be number one in both, hopefully. But we were able to, I think, be the aggressors and do it without fouling as much. And it led to getting a line and capitalizing for the line. And really, it was guys that, you know, hadn't been known as our best free throw shooters, but Josh Parrish stepped up and hit free throws. John Seidman, you know, hit some. And then we had, you know, like Vicaris was outstanding from the line. Jalen Green, I think, was 9-10 from the line. So, like, we had some guys really just put the ball in the basket.
Yeah, the thing that I saw you guys earlier this year against E-Town, and the thing that really stood out to me was just how there are certain lineups you tried out there, like, of, you know, 6-3 to 6-4 guys, and they cover the court with quickness and really have your defensive rotations on point all the time. I'm guessing that's been a real point of emphasis with you, just about your, well, how would you describe your defensive philosophy?
Yeah, the defensive philosophy, while we've made some tweaks over there, that's been probably the most consistent thing in the program in terms of maybe philosophically and you know, stylistically. It, you know, we're a team that's going to play and pick up full court man. We tend to be aggressive in terms of we're going to, you know, hard hedge ball screens, which is different for our league. You know, a lot of teams don't do that. You know, we're going to try to blow up dribble handoffs. We're going to get in passing lanes. We're going to front the post. We're, you know, and we really coach it hard. We work on defense. I mean, we've had 64 practices this year. Defense is a part of every single one of them. And we really, you know, in film breakdown, try to get it right. And we have I don't think it's a complicated defense. I really don't. But it takes a lot of effort, and it takes some instinct. It takes some toughness. And that's why when we were younger, you know, that was one thing I was really convicted in, that I knew this defense would work, and I knew if we did it right, there were flashes of it. We just weren't consistent in it. And now we're much more consistent in it, and so we don't have the breakdowns. We're more competitive at the rim. And we did tweak a couple small things, but it really, those tweaks came down to how we contest shots at the rim. We just work on, we call it walling up. Other people have different terms, but just making sure we get vertical at the rim, don't foul, make them score over us. And we make one little adjustment with how we do our ball screen coverage. And, you know, we don't have a million rules. We don't have a million different coverages. You know, we really trust that if we execute what we're supposed to, and I think because it's not complicated, guys aren't overthinking, and so we can play hard, play That's aggressive, and you need good players to do it. And any coach, I think any you know, any coach that's honest with themselves will tell you, you know, you're only as good as your players. And if you have good players and you keep it simple for them and put them in position to be successful, good things can happen.
Nick, you have a point guard from Lithuania. I think he's from Lithuania, right?
Yes, correct.
And
he's like a combo. We got a him and John kind of split duties there at the point.
Okay. Division III recruiting is really interesting. How did this kid get here from Lithuania?
So he did go to a school in the States here.
Yeah.
West Nottingham Academy down in Maryland. So that's where we saw him. We did not I don't have the crazy story of flying to Lithuania and getting a rental car and driving all over there. Actually, I've not been to that country, even though we've had a number of guys either from Lithuania with sort of Lithuania background in their families. But yeah, Vakaris actually, and I don't think he actually knows the first place I saw him play, believe it or not, because I saw him at an elite camp in the summer, a Hoop Group elite camp, and watched him, thought he's a good player, he was somebody on our radar, but with AAU, we didn't get to see him a ton. He was on a team, he didn't have as huge of a role, and just the way it worked out with our schedule and seeing him, I didn't get a great feel for him really through the summer. So in the fall, you know, as we're going through our recruiting board and talking about different guys, his name was always around, but there was a game he had against John Carroll where he went off for like 30-something points. Mm. And my assistant, who at the time, who's our full-time guy, still helps out with us, Nick Monroe, kind of brought that game to my attention, and there was film. And I'm, you know, sitting back, John Carroll's got a great program. We had Lionel Luona from there, very familiar with them. And, you know, I just started thinking, I'm like, man, I don't know how many guys we've recruited over the years would drop 30-plus in that game. And, you know, so that kind of caught my attention. Then I watched the film, and I'm like, okay, there's some real talent here. And then went out to go watch them. And, you know, it's one thing to evaluate talents. Another thing here, we've got to recruit the whole person, especially how we want to run our program. So academically, needed to be strong. I wanted to make sure he was kind of wired the way that our guys are. So just watching how he is with taking the coaching and how hard he plays, his motor, everything kept checking out. And then we were fortunate enough to get him to visit on campus. I don't know how great the visit was. I actually remember thinking, like, man, I don't think we got to put our best foot forward in this visit. He was kind of on a tight schedule, and fortunately it worked out, and for everybody. And you know, he really kind of burst on the scene as a freshman. I really thought he had a great freshman year. Wouldn't have surprised me if he got the rookie of the year in our league, but you know, we didn't win enough games. And as we've told V this year, he's got two player of the weeks, and we always celebrate as a team with those awards. And you know, he's a great player. He's done what you expect out of a good player from freshman to sophomore year.
Yeah, he has gotten
making
better.
That kind of jump.
That's what it feels like, a big jump. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's gotten more comfortable. He's tough. He's talented. He's quick, strong. I mean, he does things. I mean, there's things he can do that's it's not coaching. He's making plays out there. And, you know, he's a great student, too, and just easygoing guy, and he's a lot of fun to coach. He really is. The thing that people don't see in the box score with him is some of the defense he's played. He's a great on-ball defender. He's been tasked most nights with we had a stretch of a week. We played 3 games in 6 days. He guarded 3 of the top scorers in our league, and we won all 3 games, and we really did a good job of limiting them. And, you know, and as it, again, we play team defense, other guys, but, like, to have that responsibility to start the game and still – you know, go through the week shooting 66% and averaging 20 a game. That's pretty special stuff.
Who, other than F&M, who's the best team in the Centennial Conference?
I leave that stuff to other people.
Diplomatic.
Just, we're trying to go 1-0. We respect everybody. We don't fear anybody. So we just kind of have that mentality. I mean, I can tell you the league's really tough. There's no game that's easy. Dickinson, we were down at the half. It was a war on the road. But if you look at the standings, I mean, right now, you've got us, Gettysburg, and Hopkins all sitting in first place, tied, where it's like we beat Gettysburg beat Hopkins, and, you know, so you have that, Hopkins beat us. And then Swarthmore's still working, you know, in striking distance. I think it's, you know, the quality of the league up top is really strong right now.
It does seem strong. Yeah, it does seem like a good league this year. Yeah. I forgot. Hopkins is a team that these are all teams that F&M has had long battles with over the years.
Oh, no doubt.
Is there any team in the conference that you sort of regard as that F&M that the kids sort of regard as a rival?
That's what's tough to answer. Honestly, people ask that, and I think if, depending on what generation of F&M player you're talking to, you're going to get a different answer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think the reality is I don't think we're the most popular team in the league.
That's fair to say.
When 900-something came
and
dominate the league like he did, you don't make a lot of friends doing that, I think, in terms of rivalry. You know, so I think there's a lot of teams that you know, look at us as a rivalry game. I really try to be even keeled with it. But if you know, when I got here back in 2012, you know, we were in some great battles with Dickinson. You mm-hmm. know, there are my early memories of F&M were us and Dickinson battling for the league. And then, Swarthmore emerged, and we were battling Swarthmore for the league. Then it's like, you know, you still have, we've had battles with Gettysburg over the years. We've had battles with their sinus. Like, if you talk to them, I'm sure a certain generation of F&M player, they might tell you your sinus. And then going way back, I know there's some guys that might say Widener. You know,
yeah, that's true. So that's absolutely true.
It's the type of place where I think we're going to get a lot of people's best shot, you know, and I think, you know, whether it's Dickinson or Gettysburg or Swat or Hopkins, whoever it is, there's something along the way where there's been that. And so current players, I don't think they, to be honest, I don't think they care much about rivalries. They're young. They weren't around for some of that stuff. They know some of the history, but they're just trying to compete right now. And some guys might like some teams less than others. So it's you just got to be ready to take people's best shot and, you know, treat every game like a big game.
Yeah, you mentioned you were on Glenn Robinson's staff for 7 years as an assistant. This is your fifth year as the head coach. Well, I mean, what is it like following a guy like that? How hard was that?
Honestly, that wasn't something that I looked at that way or, mm-hmm. you know, seemed that way to me. I always looked at it. I loved working with Coach. Mm-hmm. Incredible to just learn from. And I just, you know, I spent a good 7+ years being his assistant and getting to know some of the alums at the school and really becoming ingrained in F&M. So mm-hmm. when an opportunity presented itself, of course, I would want to do everything in my power to try and get this place. It's been, you know, at the time it was home for me for a good number of years and now even more. And, you know, I had a level, I think, through Coach, really, if anything, you know, working for him and being around him, it gave me confidence that I could do this. Mm-hmm. You know, when he hired me, I was a 25-year-old coach. I mean, a lot's changed for me since then. Mm-hmm. And he really, I got to learn, like, what it takes to be a successful coach mm-hmm. or a successful program. I've been around other great coaches. Obviously, when you spend 7+ years with somebody, you're going to get a whole lot from them. But it gave me confidence, and I you know, really care deeply about the program. And so any pressure is really just more internalized pressure. There was never anything with – no one's going to fill his shoes. I mean, nobody in the country, Division III, no one's winning 967 games. Nobody's mm-hmm. having the career he had, the coach of the year. So, like, it's not shoes that I think are meant to be filled. If anything, what I hope to do is just sort of be a bridge and mm-hmm. continue to build upon a strong culture and program that he developed here over the course of his career. And if anything, it's something that excites me. I'd rather be somewhere where it matters, you mm-hmm. know, where you can win and where you're in one of the better leagues at your level. And
you can
compete for championships. And so it's just pressure. No matter where I am, I'm a competitive person. I don't like even losing in mini golf, you know, with the family. So I'm going to compete at anything. And so for me, it's just what's the best job I can do right now today. And trying to develop a program and trying to get guys to become better players and better students. And you're really just trying to make an experience that what Coach was able to do, which is make something bigger than one person. You know, can we be a part of something special? And winning helps that. And I think our team this year is starting to build and feel what's different about that.
I find it interesting what you said about, your emphasis on defense, because certainly that was, as you well know, that was the bedrock of his programs forever. I mean, how much of your coaching philosophy do you think you inherited or at least learned by osmosis from him, and how much from your other stops? I know you were at Hartwick and Lemoyne before F&M. How did you settle on your approach to things?
Yeah, it's a combination. I mean, I've always been a sponge with trying to learn as much as I could. And mm-hmm. I think I've always had a pretty good feel for, you got to be yourself. I think the one consistent thing with any good coach I've learned different coaches have different personalities, different mm-hmm. styles of play, but mm-hmm. the ones that are really good are really kind of true to what they want to do, and right. they understand who they are and what they want to get done. And I've been fortunate that I've worked for some really, really successful people, particularly if you're looking at Division III. I've worked for two guys in the Division III level, Coach Robinson, who's the winningest coach ever, and Todd McGinnis at Hardwick, who's mm-hmm. done just maybe one of the most underrated coaching jobs right now with what he's done at Case Western and what he did at Hardwick. I mean, mm-hmm. he built that program back up and has done what nobody else has ever done at Case Western. I mean, he's a winner, and they're, I don't know what they are right now. I don't pay attention as much to that stuff. I know they're like top five. But, you know, so I've learned from really good guys. And you know, Todd's a very, very different coach than Coach Robinson. And so I took some from him, some from Coach. I've watched countless, I can't even begin, clinics. Mm-hmm. I have great friends in the coaching business where I've taken stuff from and just try to add a little bit that makes sense within our general philosophy. But there's no doubt since I'm in the program here at F&M, there's definitely a lot that sort of transferred over in terms of, I think, our philosophy. But you know, we're pretty drastically different looking offensive like system right now mm-hmm. than we were say 12 years ago. But you know, you just try, and I'm still going to continue to try and learn and tweak things if I can. And some of it's X and O's, some of it's, you know, for the culture of your program, some of it's mm-hmm. it's as simple as academic advising. But like, I've always tried to, if something I think is going to help us and make us better and it applies to our program, I'm going to try to do it.
Nick, for people who don't know, there's more schools in Division III than there are in Division I, and it's hard to get in the tournament. Talk about, for people who don't know, how do you get into the NCAAs? Obviously, if you win the Centennial, you're in. But otherwise, what's the process?
Yeah, so the easiest thing, win your conference tournament,
yep.
And you're going. If not, like everybody thinks, it's similar to Division I. Well, I guess it was. Now Division I's expanded to 68 teams, but it's yeah. a 64-team tournament. The difference being, in Division I, there's, I don't know, 30-something at-large teams.
Yeah.
Division III, it's much less. There's more conferences, so if you don't get your AQ, you got, you know, 400 schools, close to 400 schools fighting for 20 spots.
Yeah, wow.
So it's very tough, and the metrics are, while it's very clear, there's still an element of, you know, how you're ranked in your region and then how that measures with that committee at the time. But the three main criteria are winning percentage, strength of schedule, and regional record versus regionally ranked opponents. Those are the three things they base it off of. It's not like Division One, at least it's not supposed to be, where, you know, they combine computers with the eye test and which team should be in and factoring injuries into seeding and everything else.
Right,
it's a much more, you know, sort of just, you know, numbers-based, information-based approach to it. And then there's 10 regions. And so these regional committees will rank teams. Some have more than others, so like we're Region 5. So once they get to the regional rankings, they'll rank them, and then you get all your AQs in, and then it's like who's the top-line team in the 10 regions. They're on the board together, and somebody gets taken. Once that team gets taken, the next team moves up to the line from that region, and you just keep going until you fill the field.
So it's tough. It's tough to get in. It's tough to get in if you don't win your league.
Especially if you're, depending on where you're ranked, you could get blocked. You can never get to the table if a team in your region ahead of you doesn't get off the table.
Right, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about some of the guys who have been with you for a few years now, and kind of the foundational guys for your team, like Omar Nichols. He's a senior guard. Josh Perry is a senior forward. And John Seidman, who you also mentioned, he's a junior guard, but he's played a lot of ball for you. Let me ask you about Omar first, because he strikes me as a pretty impressive kid, a guy who's had, you know, two internships at Price Waterhouse. He was a three-year captain in high school, and I just like the way he carries himself. He can shoot the ball, but he just seems like he's a real solid kid for you. What can you tell us about how he's gone about his business these last 4 years? Actually, 5 years, I guess.
No, four. We didn't get the extra. This is his third year playing with us. I wish I had one more with him.
Yeah.
But he's, Omar was one of the guys who, so his freshman year was the COVID year, he didn't play.
Mm-hmm.
And so his freshman basketball year was his sophomore year. And right from the jump, he's a very confident kid. He was a good player, and he's just continued to work. The thing that I love about his game is, you know, he's really on the defensive end improved just dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
He's always going to be a guy who can make shots. But the thing with Omar, like, he's that guy I can, like, if there's a guy I need to extend for 35 minutes in a game, he's going to be a guy I can do that, and he can figure it out. He knows how to, you know, play fatigued and play through. And, he's a guy that really is, when you need a bucket, he can find a way to get a shot up, you know, if you give him any airspace there. So he really puts a lot of pressure on the defense, and he's gotten better. One of the game areas in his game, which we told him he needs to continue to get better at, was he's a great shooter, but wasn't always as good getting to the basket and getting to the rim, and he's improved that part of his game too. So he's just continued to develop. He didn't rest on just being a pretty good catch-and-shoot college player. He's become a complete player, it's paying off for us this year and for him.
And what about Power? He was as much of a football guy at Milton Hershey as he was a basketball guy, correct?
Yeah, he played football as well. Mm-hmm. Josh, another one, kind of with Omar, same class from day one, was able to carve out a role with us. And, I don't think it's any secret, anybody who follows our team closely, when he's on the floor, our stretch where we had trouble last year, he was hurt.
Mm-hmm.
When he's on the floor and he's able to stay out of foul trouble, be healthy, and play 25 minutes or more, we're really tough to beat.
Mm-hmm.
He just impacts the game everywhere. Every coach advises their players, I think, at his best. He's the best big man in our league. I felt that way for the past couple years. And he can score inside. He can score either hand. He's mobile. He's a really intelligent player. He can screen. Mm-hmm. He can pass. He's very good defensively in terms of knowing assignment and staying in front. He's strong, quick off the ground. He impacts the game everywhere. He's a great rebounder. He's got great hands. If he was better from the free throw line, I'm not sure there's an answer for him.
Right.
In our league, our level, but he's even improving there. And in the recent couple of weeks, hopefully that can keep up. But he's just it's a comfort level with him out there. He changes the game just by being on the floor. And whether it's scoring, rebounding, defense, screening, the way the offense flows with him out there as a five-man, he's a special player.
And Seidman, he's averaging 7 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists. Last year he was more of a scorer, so he's sort of adapted a little bit this year, has he not?
Yeah, I think it's just we've never it's kind of part of our system. We're just a team. We're just concerned about our shot.
Mm-hmm.
And when John was younger, we needed him to score more. Now we've got, he's got a sidekick in the backcourt that can really score. We've got more options that can score off the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And he's such a great facilitator. I mean, he's number one in the conference in assists, number one in assist turnover ratio. I'd imagine he's the best or one of the best rebounding guards in the league. He can guard 1 through 4.
Mm-hmm.
He's like my Swiss Army knife. If he's on the floor, we can figure it out because he can play so many different positions. He knows everybody, where everybody should be on the floor. He's tough. He's a gamer. He'll make plays. He's not afraid. And he's just never too high, never too low. Like, the same John shows up every day. Every day he shows up ready to play with the same approach. And he's just, as a coach, it's like there's a massive comfort level with having a player like him. And he does so many things for us on the floor.
Hey, Nick, keep it going, man. Very impressed with what you've been doing. F&M basketball is one of those things in our area that you want them to be good. They're a fixture, and they should be good, and we're glad to see you rolling the way you are. And we appreciate you spending some time with us today, man. Yeah,
thanks so much.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. It's, the one thing I could say is for people in the community that listen and want to come out, this is the team you want to come out and watch play.
Yeah.
This group plays hard. I can promise people you show up, you're going to see a team that competes. We're going to play the right way. We got kids that do the right things. on and off the court, mm-hmm. and we're in the thick of it. So we need that support. We want people to come out. Mazur, love to see it get filled up here down the stretch as we play some big games and chase the conference title.
Yeah, that was what jumped out at me when I saw you guys against E-Town, just how hard everybody played and just seemed like how everybody likes to play and likes to play with one another. That really jumped out at me, just the energy you guys have.
Yeah, top to bottom in that locker room, it's a great group. They pull for each other. They compete with each other.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Between the guys you mentioned, I'll tell you another guy who's just been critical to our success in terms of the overall sort of culture of our team, Jalen Green, a converted football player.
Yeah, that's the guy. We love him.
Captain. He's a heck of a kid and player. I don't know where we'd be without him
really
in that locker
defender.
Room. Football's misfortune was our benefit with that wrist injury. He's a special one. I could go on about every guy.
Yeah. Well, that was so interesting. You mentioned Jalen's name because I was sitting next to Mike when we were at the E-Town game. And I just said to Mike, boy, that guy just loves to play. Yeah. You know what I mean?
He was critical in that.
Yeah. It just really jumped out at me. This guy just likes to play, you know?
Yeah. Tough, competes, mm-hmm. great kid. He can make shots. He's the kind of guy that can help any team. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Okay, Nick, we appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon. I'll see you soon, actually. And we really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Nick.
Alrighty.
Take care. Be well. Yeah, I mean, he's right. I mean, and you were right, too, just about what F&M has meant to the community. I mean, I'd go to games and you'd see the same faces in the stands.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when Glenn was there, it would be like local coaches would show up and like, what's the deal here? Yeah. You know, they would want to know, you know, what's he all about and what are they all about? And for a lot of years, they would inevitably have, you know, a stretch where the other team just couldn't score.
Yeah.
So this is sort of the same kind of deal.
I think it's tweaked a little bit
for
the three-point era.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what it is. That's what it is. So when he's talking about blitzing the pick and rolls and getting, mm-hmm. you know, you got to get out and attack a little bit on the perimeter now. Glenn, although he was not a Bobby Knight guy.
He was a Dean Smith guy.
He was a Dean Smith guy who was the ultimate moldable guy. Glenn, he ran that North Carolina passing game where the big guys did
all the time. Yes.
Yeah, and he sort of played that the helping but very aggressive man to man.
Yeah, they would get up into you.
Yeah. Play the ball very aggressive, but also the help recover thing and all that, the sort of more traditional half court man to man. It's just been tweaked for a different game. It's a different game now.
Yeah, for a long time, Glenn's teams did not shoot a lot of threes. Certainly Nick's teams seem more inclined in that direction. And a couple numbers jumped off the stat sheet at me. The opponents are shooting 40%. They're shooting 31% from three against F&M. So that'll win you a lot of games if you can lock people up like that.
Yeah, and it's almost everybody is a pretty good defender.
It seems so.
I think the Green kid might be the best defender.
Oh, my God, because he's a long, lanky kid. And I will not forget that. We were sitting there, and I said, geez, that guy just likes to play.
Yeah.
And because he just got after it. And I'm sure that's how he is every day.
Yeah.
And that can be contagious.
Yeah, and really, obviously doesn't care if he scores.
No.
You know, which is
invaluable.
Is
a nice
thing to have.
I do like their team. I mentioned Omar Nichols. I want to write about Omar. I know you're going to be talking to him in a little while, but... Yeah, I looked at his LinkedIn. The last two summers, an intern at PricewaterhouseCooper. That ain't bad in Philadelphia. He's from the main line.
And
the other thing that jumped off, he was a captain from his sophomore year on at Friends Central on the main line.
That's crazy.
So there's something special about that kid, I would say.
He's one of those guys who, when he shoots a three and it's a decent look, you expect it to go in.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
really a good thing. He's a better three. Like a lot of these guys, he's a better three-point shooter than he is a foul shooter.
Yes.
That has been a little bit of a problem, but they might be getting better at it.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just get better. It's a skill, and you work at it, you get better.
The numbers that jump out is, Para and Seidman are both like 40% foul shooters. That's a real concern when it comes down to big games.
Really. Yeah, and Seidman being a perimeter player who has the ball a lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's a... But yeah, it is interesting to see this happening because it has been a while that since Effing has been really good, and now they're good again. I mean, they're tied for first with Gettysburg and Johns Hopkins, and you know he said they don't really have a rival, and he said how they're not liked. Well, yeah, there has been a lot of that.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah. But Johns Hopkins through the years has traditionally been the team that, you know, they've had to go through. They've been good. You know, Bill Nelson was the coach there for a long time. Really good guy and a very respected coach. And had, you know, Andy Enfield was there, a guy from Shippensburg who now coaches at USC, coached Florida Gulf Coast.
Gulf Coast!
Yes, who lit up the Wells Fargo Center in NCAAs a few years ago. So that was an interesting stretch. But, you know, traditionally, those have kind of been the top dogs, you know, often. Yeah.
I think that league is pretty good right now. It is a different mix.
Yeah.
What Swarthmore has done is pretty amazing.
Because they were downtrodden forever.
Oh, my God. And how do you recruit? And I mean, F&M is a great school academically, but Swarthmore is, like, off the charts.
Yep.
I mean, in terms of admission standards and everything. Wow.
Yeah, and he mentioned Landry Kosmelski. He was a guy who was a Bob McKillop disciple. And
That's right. And I forgot about that.
And he went there, and they kind of went, you know, straight up. The arrow was straight up. That one year they were denied the Final Four because of COVID.
Yeah.
And then I think the next year they lost in the championship game, if memory serves.
Yeah, they had a 3 or 4 year stretch where they won like 80. They were like 85-10 or something.
Yeah, it was
like
ridiculous.
That. And probably would have won a natty and lost in a championship game once also.
Yeah. So it is entertaining. I mean, I like covering hoops at this level because A, it's a hell of a lot better than people realize, and B, these are guys that are well-spoken and can really help you out when you want to write a story. I'm very selfish about that, obviously.
That's the part nobody thinks about but us. But
but it is true. You go to these guys and they are bright people and can really talk the game.
I remember, this is probably, it's at least 10 years ago now, MIT had a really good team.
I remember that. And they played at F&M.
And their NCAA regional was at F&M.
Yeah, it was a great game. That was when Georgia was there for F&M.
Yeah,
Georgia Milligan.
F&M was very good, too. But they had a bunch of guys. I mean, they had a guy who would spend the previous year, like, hitchhiking through Russia.
As one will.
And they had guys who had their own startups, their own companies. I mean, it was just amazing kids. So I wrote a piece about them. Before the regional even happened,
right.
And then they won it, and they got to the championship game, national championship game, and lost.
I remember that.
And they sent me an MIT shirt, and
so there you go,
like a long sleeve MIT T-shirt.
I like that. Long sleeve T-shirts are not too shabby.
That's right. That's right.
But yeah, and he's right about Mazur Gym. When it's the big games and it's full, that is a really cool little venue
for a game. And it doesn't happen very often.
No,
it doesn't happen in high school basketball very often anymore. I really miss that.
Yeah, agreed.
I miss the packed gym and the and
the energy,
sort of edgy, sweaty, energetic atmosphere of it. You don't see nearly as much of that as you used to. And
a couple of memories of that involving Lebanon County kids. A, when they went to the Final Four in 1991, Will Lasky made an off-the-wrong-foot three-pointer from in front of their bench to tie the game at the end of regulation, and they won it over and beat Rochester to go to the Final Four. And we've had Will Lasky on here. All-time great player.
Yep. Two-time All-American.
Yeah, great player at F&M, great player in high school, and a really great guy. Spent his life teaching, and just a wonderful human being in addition to being a great player. And the other memory involves Chris Kelleher. Okay, they're playing Wilkes it was also a regional final. And Kelleher, of course, is like 5'7", maybe.
A little bigger than that, but not much.
Yeah.
Not much, but a great defender.
A tough little guy and a great defender. So he gets a steal, and it's a one-on-one with, like, the biggest guy from Wilkes. He's got to be, like, a foot taller. He's the only guy back. Of course, Kelleher being Kelleher, he goes right to the rim and tries to score. And the guy gets fouled. Wasn't a great foul shooter. Made them both. And they end up winning by, like, 20.
Yeah. Against a very good team.
Yeah.
I did not see that game, but I have rarely been more flabbergasted by a result.
Yeah.
Than that. I just, the margin of victory.
Yeah, because they were you know, Wilkes is a great team.
I think I had seen Wilkes play maybe against Lebanon Valley that year or something.
Yeah.
I had seen that Wilkes team play.
Right.
And I had seen that F&M team play. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that score, that was a jaw dropper.
Wilkes had a guy named Matt Labuda. They called him Labuda the Shooter. And he had he had 21, but Chris Loftus, another Lebanon County guy, a very good defensive player. He was guarding him, but he actually matched him. He had like 21 himself, so it was a really great game by FNM. But it's like those games in that gym when it's full, really great.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah. Absolutely.
So anyway, we wanted to talk a little bit about NFL playoffs. There are now 8 teams left. In the AFC, Houston is at Baltimore. Kansas City is at Buffalo. This cracks me up. Patrick Mahomes' first road playoff game of his career. In the NFC, Green Bay at San Francisco, Tampa Bay at Detroit. So what do you want to say about this stuff, Mike?
Well, just a footnote on that thing about Mahomes. I believe if not for that wide receiver lined up offside call,
it would be at Kansas City.
It would be at Kansas City. Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Here's something, a couple things about the Packers and the Cowboys.
Okay.
First of all, the Packers are just smacking the shit out of them, and I'm not seeing anything on Twitter from my many Packer friends. So I actually tweeted myself.
Yes, you did.
Are these guys trying to not jinx anything?
I think there was an element. There was definitely an element of that.
Yes.
There was an element of that. There was an element of disbelief, I think.
Yeah.
But they've obviously found their quarterback. I mean, they're definitely moving up in class. I can't see them beating San Francisco. I don't think they can block him, and I don't think they can tackle him. But they found their quarterback.
Well, they might be able to block him decently. Their own line's pretty good.
It's played really well this year. But San Francisco with Nick Bosa, Eric Armstead, Chase Young is there.
That's
a lot of guys.
They're the better.
And then you have on the other side, you got, you know, McCaffrey and Debo Samuel.
They just have more really good players than anybody else, and they're really well coached. And one of the reasons why they have more good players than anybody else is John Lynch, the GM, and that seems like a perfect coach and GM relationship.
It seems
and
Lynch has been willing to take big swings. You know, you got, you know, Chase Young this year. You got McCaffrey. I mean, these are great players. Let's go get them.
Yeah,
you know,
they've done a great job.
They have.
And they've been a little bit unlucky with injuries, so maybe they haven't cashed in on the great job, but maybe that's coming.
Yeah, I think the other thing in San Francisco's favor is the fact that I think they feel like, you know, they were so close last year, and then Brock Purdy got hurt against the Eagles in the NFC Championship. So I suspect there's like a different edge to their approach to this postseason.
Yeah, right. I guess that carries, and I think they're the favorite.
I think so. I mean, I think a Baltimore-San Francisco Super Bowl would be amazing. I mean, Baltimore beat the hell out of them.
I think they're the two best teams.
Yeah, I think they're the two best teams. But Baltimore beat the hell out of them in San Francisco, which boggles the mind.
Yeah, they went through a stretch. The 49ers went through a stretch where they were pretty bad this year, just a couple weeks. But now, here's something that has baffled me for a lifetime about football.
Go.
And this game was an excellent illustration of it. The Packers and Dallas, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Dallas struggles to stop the run. That's one of their weaknesses as a team, okay? So I'm watching that game, and play after play after play after play after play, it looks to me like they've got nobody in the box.
Interesting.
Or they maybe have like one linebacker, like four linemen, and they're moving Micah around, you know? And I'm thinking, if you're the Packers, you come up to the line of scrimmage and see this, you're running the ball every time, and they did run the hell out of the ball, and that kind of set up play action, and they ended up smacking the crap out of them. Now Dan Quinn is this great defensive mind, the Cowboys' D coordinator.
Correct.
Great defensive mind. He looks like he's going to be a head coach somewhere. He's interviewing, they say. What the hell? But I'm watching this and I'm thinking, well, I must be missing something. I'm not a football. I never played football. I never coached football. I must be missing something. The next morning, Rex Ryan, another really good defensive mind, is on the ESPN's morning show. And he says the same thing that I just said. And he said, Green Bay had 54 offensive plays, 48 of them, Dallas had 6 defensive backs in the field. So they were in the dime package was like their base defense, and they can't stop the run.
Yeah, that's weird.
How can that be?
I didn't even realize that until you mentioned that. I mean, it was basically the Packers did whatever they wanted on offense. They had guys running free in their secondary, even with six defensive backs. I mean, Romeo Doubs, 6 for 151.
Yeah.
And it's like the Packers, the last 3 weeks, they've had a different 100-yard receiver, which, you know, doesn't happen.
Yeah, they don't have just one guy. Yeah, no. That's right. But anyway, and then that evening on Pardon the Interruption, Jeff Saturday was on there, and he said the same thing.
What are they doing?
How can that be? That seems so...
Yeah.
That seems so odd. I'm sure if Dan Quinn was sitting here, he'd have an explanation for it.
I would think so. I mean, I don't know. That boggles my mind because they struggled to stop the run, and then they didn't really address that.
It's not just they're in their nickel all the time. They're in their dime all the time. Six defensive backs. And they didn't cover them that great with six defensive backs.
They did not cover them.
That's something that is always...
Yeah.
It baffled me how something can strategic like that can seem so obvious and I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So we have the other NFC game, Tampa Bay at Detroit. I mean, obviously Detroit would be a heavy favorite there, but Tampa really smacked the Eagles around, which, I mean, the Eagles are just a mess.
Yeah, I think that was I was very impressed with the Packers. To me, the Eagles, and maybe it's because I sort of like the Eagles, but to me that was more of the... They've just fallen into a ditch than it was. Tampa played well. Yeah, Tampa played well. Pass rush and Baker Mayfield played fine.
Yeah, he had a couple of drops or else it would have been worse.
Yeah, he had really good numbers, and that game was not close at all.
No.
And the Eagles have just fallen through the black hole in space.
It's crazy to me. There's got to be internal issues there. Apparently they're going to keep their head coach. I mean, usually if you fire the head coach, it's happened by now, right?
Yeah.
But they haven't fired their head coach. Right. And speaking of that, Mike McCarthy, they've already said they're going to retain him in Dallas, which is interesting to me. But
you wonder if they looked at Belichick and Belichick said, I don't want to go to Dallas. I don't want to deal with all that.
Belichick and Jerry, that doesn't strike me as an interesting marriage.
I don't know. Maybe that's a total guess. It'll be interesting to see where Belichick ends up and what that says about his thinking and that team.
Right.
We'll see, but it's not going to be Dallas. That's for sure.
And Houston at Baltimore. Obviously, Baltimore is the favorite, but Houston, I think, has a puncher's chance because C.J. Stroud is excellent.
He's really good, and they have a really good defense, and I think they have a really good coach.
Yeah, it seems so. Yeah, D'Amico Ryans, who's got to be in the mix for Coach of the Year. I mean, Cleveland's Kevin Stefanski will probably get it because I think they had five guys start at quarterback. but you know, you got to give D'Amico Ryans a hat tip because they've had a great year.
Yeah, that was apparently a great hire and a defensive first guy for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But a really smart guy, a really sharp guy, and a strong personality. And Stroud is just really good. So
I really love the way
they're definitely on the rise. I mean, what they were a year ago and where they are now, big difference.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that when we had Bill Rabinowitz on from the Columbus Dispatch earlier, how C.J. Stroud has broken that trend of Ohio State quarterbacks, you know, face planting in the NFL. I mean, he's been really good.
Yeah, you know, I finally sort of convinced myself that maybe I was overrating these Ohio State quarterbacks because they're kind of a system phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then this guy comes along and he's not a system phenomenon.
No, my God. He's just excellent. And he seems completely unflappable. And he's got good receivers. And he certainly knows how to use them.
Seeing him play, not up close because we're 10 miles up in the air, but at Penn State, was so impressed with, you could see him. He hit a slant to Marvin Harrison like 150 times in that game. It seemed third and six. Well, you know what we're doing. And you could see him and Harrison body languaging with each other and nodding with each other. Yeah. And you know what to do. It's man coverage. You know what to do. And there was a lot of that. I think he has a really good feel. That's maybe where he's ahead of Justin Fields.
Mm-hmm.
Just has a really good feel for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually... Just to go back to the Packers for a minute, that's where Jordan Love has impressed me. He just seems to get it. I mean, midway through the season, he didn't, but now it's just suddenly something fell into place for him, and where he's just, like I said,
he made some throws in that game.
He did.
And then there were times when they totally fooled him and just throw it up there, and it was like a punt. There was a couple of those, but that's what you're supposed to do, get rid of it. And
His last touchdown pass, it was like almost a little Brett Favre-ish because he was rolling to his right. It was a fourth down play from like the three, and he threw like a sidearm bullet to Romeo Doubs, and it's like he's stuck from behind, and all you see are hands.
Friend of the needle.
He
fitted in a window.
It was interesting. I mean, our friend Mark Echo, who's also been our pod, he's also a Packers fan, and he said, well, there was a reason that Jordan Love went ahead of Jalen Hurts in the 2020 draft.
In terms of just talent for the passing game, I would definitely put Love ahead of Hurts. We'll see what happens.
But it looks like, I mean, suddenly midseason, something just suddenly fell into place for him because it wasn't there the first half. They were 3-6 at one point.
I wasn't sure they got that right, investing in him, and to the extent that they,
nor was I.
give him credit. That's what you got to do, man. That's what Big Red did with Mahomes. Mm-hmm. People forget that. I mean, not everybody saw that.
No.
Think it's amazing when you watch the talent he has now, but.
Oh, my gosh.
He's such a freak, but not everybody saw it. Not everybody agreed with it. That was a deep quarterback class, and he was, according to a lot of people, fourth or fifth in that group, but not according to Big Red, he was right.
And speaking of which, right. Big Red, I mean, at Buffalo, Kansas City's receivers have been a disaster all year, but Buffalo, they've had a lot of injuries. I mean, they've been through a linebacker, A.J. Klein, they kind of signed him off the street, and he was their leading tackler last week.
Yeah.
So it's they've kind of had a rough year injury-wise, and they kind of got it together late in the year. They won, I think, 6 in a row, but they haven't really dominated everybody. They beat Pittsburgh 31-17. Oh, I know. Speaking of that game, there was a play where Josh Allen ran for a touchdown, and he did the fake slide thing, which I think that needs to be addressed.
How do they let him do that?
I don't know. I mean,
is there no rule about that, right?
There is no rule about it. To me, it should be unsportsmanlike conduct if you do it, and that'll wipe it out right away. Because it's like they put it in to help, to protect the quarterbacks, and now it's being used as a strategy.
Yeah, that can't happen. Yeah, and he did it pretty subtly. I didn't really notice it until the replay, honestly. Which I guess.
Yeah, he kind of stopped.
Yeah, you know? But here's the thing. To me, real simple. As soon as he fakes it, well, that's where you mark the ball.
Yeah, I think
that's
fair too. Because it can't happen. It just can't happen. It's not the intent of the rule was to protect the quarterback, and now they're going to use it to their advantage. That just strikes me as really wrong.
It is wrong. The blatant one that I remember was Kenny Pickett when he was still at Pitt, and he had this long run. But that one was a lot less subtle than
Josh Allen.
The other day.
That could very well be the most interesting game this
week. That almost feels like flopping a little bit.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, that's a good comparison.
I think that is the most interesting game. I think Buffalo can win that game.
I think so too. And that would be interesting to me. I mean, Buffalo-Baltimore would not be a horrible conference championship game.
That side of the league has the better quarterbacks. And look at these matchups. Look at the guys who are still playing. Lamar Jackson and Mahomes and Josh Allen.
And C.J. Stroud, I think if the chalk holds in the NFC, then you have Detroit going to San Francisco. Detroit's a damn good team. You know, they're a tough team. But I'm not sure anybody beats San Francisco in the NFC.
No, I can't see. I can't see the Lions winning at San Francisco. Well, who knows? I mean,
that's why you're playing, Mike.
That's why. It's time for a cliche, and you deliver. Way to be. One thing about the Detroit Lions, I think I probably said this before, but I'm 65 years old. There's never been a time in my life when they were one of the best three or four teams in the league. Not the best, one of the best three or four teams in the league.
Right.
They have to be the least successful franchise in American sports.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you could argue the Clippers, but the Clippers have been pretty good the last 20 years.
You could argue the Clippers, actually, if you really think about it. Because, I mean, was there a time when they were one of the best three or four teams in the league? Maybe not.
I don't know. I mean,
They've been around pretty long.
If you go back to the Buffalo Braves.
Yeah. Oh, I love that team.
I did too.
Yeah, I was a big fan of that team.
Oh yeah, Bob McAdoo and Ernie DiGregorio. They had some players up there. Randy Smith, one of the more underrated players
Randy
in NBA history.
Smith. God bless him. Jack Maron.
Yeah, they were good.
How about Ernie DiGregorio as a defender?
Not so great.
Not good.
Not ideal. Good. Not ideal.
I remember one time, 100 years ago, Jerry West, who was my hero, you know.
Sure.
And they played the Braves, and I think he went for 38. Mm-hmm. And he said, and Ernie DeGregorio was trying to guard him.
Not good.
And he said after the game, you know, I hate to say this, but if I'd have been healthy, I could have had a pretty big scoring night.
So 38 wasn't big
enough. Yeah, he had 38, again, with Ernie D trying to guard him.
That's the most Jerry West thing ever.
He had 38 and he was not pleased with it.
He had a pretty big scoring night if I hadn't been healthy. I think his ankle was all banged up in it.
The Jerry West tales are amazing. Like, he won't wear green because of the Celtics. He will not wear green. He's like this... So tightly, he literally couldn't watch the Lakers play when he was an executive there. He had to go like either wander the hallways or literally leave the arena.
And the interior, like, tightly woundedness of him. Boy, I loved that guy so much as a kid. And what a career. He'd be a good podcast guy.
Yeah, he would. I mean, he was kind of a tragic hero because he lost to the Celtics so many times in the finals.
He only ever won it once, and he was sort of past his prime,
right,
and was kind of going through a shooting slump, I remember, during the playoffs.
Yeah, I remember that as well, 72,
But the team was great. The team was dominant.
Yeah, because that was, you know, they asked Wilt to be a rebounder and defender, which is, he was great at it. And then in the finals against the Lakers, or against the Knicks, they said, well, I think we need to unleash you, because they had Jerry Lucas guarding him, and then Wilt went back to being Wilt.
Wilt went for 45 in one of the games.
So, you know, it was kind of an interesting transition. That team won 33 in a row. Now, there's a record I don't think will ever be broken, just be the way, because the travel in the NBA is so ridiculous.
And, I mean, how many did the Heat win with LeBron?
It was 20-something, like 26, 20, maybe?
It was close, but not that close.
I mean, that's still seven more games.
Yeah, that'll be tough.
That'll be tough to break. And, you know, and we've talked before about Wilt records. I mean, there's a whole bunch of those that'll never break.
Well, that's
I mean, they look like misprints, his records.
And then let's talk Cy Young a little bit. To me, that's the most unbreakable record in sports.
511 wins. There was a comedian named John Campaner. What'd they give a win for back then? Did he go to a carnival and knock down five bottles? Hey, that's a win, Cy.
There's probably no currently active pitcher who will get 511 career decisions.
I know. It's crazy. I mean,
and obviously it has to do with the way pitchers were used literally 100 years ago compared to now. It's huge, but if we're literally talking unbreakability, that to me is at the top of the list.
511 wins. That's just nuts.
That's insane. There's probably nobody currently active who will get 300. Who will get close? Well,
that's anymore. That is true, because it's like, you know, everybody's like a 5 or 6 inning pitcher anyway. They don't want pitchers to face the third time through the
lineup. Yeah, right. I mean, I get it, but yeah.
Somebody posted on Twitter recently just about Bob Gibson's starts in 1968 when he somehow went 22-9, even though his earned run average was 1.12, which doesn't even seem possible that you could lose 9 games.
But that is incredible, although. That was the most pitching dominated era since the dead ball era, and it seemed like every game was 2-1 and 3-2. And but 1.12.
And so Bob Gibson starts. I forget, it was like every game was at least 8 innings, and there were a couple where he pitched like 11 and 12. It was ridiculous. Those his starts that year.
He was a good hoopster too, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah. But I'm just trying to picture a manager coming out to the mound and trying to get the ball from Bob Gibson if he pitched now.
Yeah.
The guy would die. Bob Gibson would not be pleased.
He's going to have to kill you. Skipper, sorry.
We're going to bury you right behind the mound here, and I'm going to continue working.
Wow.
But different era, obviously.
Absolutely.
But anyway, as always, we digress, but not the worst thing.
Yeah, not the worst thing. We're proud of our digressions.
Indeed.
So what do we got next week?
We got that Andrew Callahan who covers, used to work for the Lebanon Daily News, now covers the New England Patriots for the Boston Herald, and will come on, and I'm sure have some interesting insights.
I have a lot of questions for him that I can think of right off the top of my head with this Belichick thing. I am fascinated.
By then, Belichick might very well have a job.
He might.
He's interviewed twice with the Atlanta Falcons, which amazes me. He does not strike me as a guy for that market.
They don't have a quarterback. Everybody says they have a really good roster.
Do they?
I'm dubious. I remember in the last 3 or 4 years, a lot of times, the New Orleans Saints have an awesome 53-man roster. Okay, they're...
What did they get them?
They're 8-9. I mean, yeah. Awesome. They are, you know, spectacularly missing a quarterback, utterly missing a quarterback. But how, are you going to get a difference maker in the draft? Are you going to get a difference maker in the trade? They're not going to get Caleb Williams.
They might have to settle with a recovering from injury Kirk Cousins or somebody like that.
Yeah,
that might be where they're at.
And I like Kirk Cousins, but that's not going to get him to.
I wouldn't think, but Belichick, he's kind of a defensive guy, so I guess he would get an offensive guy to address that side of the ball. But it doesn't strike me as the right situation. Yeah, it almost seems like he's leveraging that to get somewhere else.
Well, maybe. We'll see. Obviously, Dallas is off the table. You would think the Eagles are off the table.
You would think.
I don't know. Jeffrey Lurie gets it in his mind that I can get Bill Belichick here. Would he?
Yeah. I don't know. Here was an interesting thing somebody said about Jeffrey Lurie the other day. The coaches he's hired have never been head coaches before. That's true in Sirianni's case. It was true in Andy Reid's case. True, in Chip Kelly's case, he was never an NFL head coach. That's really interesting to me. But if Bill Belichick's out there, you got to kick the tires, don't you?
how many owners in the league are kicking the tires, regardless of who their head coach is?
Yeah.
I mean, some of these owners that are kind of clueless, but they know who Bill Belichick is, right?
One would think.
Yeah, if you don't, you're in the wrong
line of work.
Yeah, line of work or whatever. All right.
So anyway, but Andrew will come on, and he's been a guest here before, and he's a really super bright guy, and I'm sure he'll have a lot of insights into that whole turn of events.
Again, I'm endlessly fascinated by that situation.
Yeah, indeed.
I'm looking forward to getting into it. All right, gang, that's it. It's been a pleasure. He's Gordy. I'm Mike. See ya.
See you later.